Welcome everyone to this session on Beneath the Paving Stones, Situationism. The speaker will be Chris DiPasquale, who is a member of Socialist Alternative at Monash University. He's currently doing his honours in French, so he'll be able to pronounce all of the words correctly, hopefully. He's an activist also in the campaign against racism and fascism here in Melbourne. So please make him welcome.
Thanks, Vashti. So I thought, well, we're at the Marxism Conference. This takes place over the Easter weekend every year, and tomorrow's Easter Sunday, so I thought we might begin with an Easter tale. So on Easter Sunday in 1950, at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, I'm sure everyone's familiar with the resident hunchback there, a Dominican monk, dressed in his full robes, ascends the rostrum to deliver a sermon. Now, this is Easter Sunday Mass. It's a Mass that is televised live nationally. And so there's this monk, he walks up to the lectern and he begins to deliver the following sermon. "Today, Easter Day of the Holy Year, here, under the emblem of Notre Dame of Paris, I accuse the Universal Catholic Church of the lethal diversion of our living strength toward an empty heaven. I accuse the Catholic Church of swindling. I accuse the Catholic Church of infecting the world with its funereal morality, of being the running sore on the decomposed body of the West. Verily, I say unto you, God is dead."
Woo-hoo!
Now, the sermon continues on. It goes on in that vein. But firstly, the phrasing here, it's significant. He says, "I accuse the Catholic Church this, I accuse the Catholic Church that," which, you know, in French is "j'accuse," which is the title of a very famous open letter penned by the 19th century author Emile Zola, accusing the French state of anti-Semitism. And so there's a, you know, they're trying to draw on a very radical kind of document. But I dare say the intertextuality of the monk's sermon is lost on the congregation, who by now are scandalised. Their initial confusion at seeing a Dominican monk get up in front of the entire Easter Mass, in front of live television, to declare that God is dead, quickly gave way to rage. And it was a lucky thing, it's reported that it was a lucky thing that the police soon showed up to arrest and escort this so-called monk away, because if it weren't for police protection, he would have been torn to shreds by the congregation there. Now, you might have guessed by now that this was not a monk, of the Dominican order or otherwise. He was, in fact, a member of what was called the Letterist International, and his name was Michel Moore. Now, the Letterists were an avant-garde artistic kind of organisation. And by the 50s, they'd started to become more political and kind of move towards a critique of society. And Moore was from a radical wing of that organisation, which would go on to form what was called the Situationist International 7 years later. And so that's kind of the subject of the talk today. So I begin with a story because I think you can see right from the beginning, before the word Situationist was even in use, that the people who founded the Situationist current, people like this guy, Michel Moore, these people were controversial. They were radical. They were looking for any opportunity, or creating any opportunity they could, to kind of mess with society, to just rebuke the kind of the bourgeois, genteel order of the day. And I think this willingness to defy conservative norms is what attracted so many young people to at least identify as Situationists, even if only in name. Now, by May 1968, the term Situationism became much more widespread, and it's similar to the way that the press uses, for example, the way they use the term Antifa today. It's a very nebulous kind of thing. The way that they, for example, with the word Antifa, they use it to describe anyone really who attends like an anti-racist protest. Well, the term Situationist was also used in a pretty lazy way by the press of the time to evoke, a sense of danger, a sense of delinquency. It was a term thrown around with differing definitions and meanings. For example, according to one newspaper, they were the vanguard of the student movement. According to another, situationism was a technique of intellectual terrorism, worse for actual members of of the Situationist International in France, who saw themselves as thoroughgoing Marxists. The press would often accuse them of being anarchists. And according to one newspaper article, they were more anarchists than the anarchists, who they find too bureaucratic. So the Situationists, found this characterization particularly offensive. And what makes it all the more confusing is that there were actually large numbers of students during the May 68 revolt in France who did wear the mantle, or did wear the label of Situationism without being a formal member of an organization that was Situationist. So who were the Situationists? Well, in short, the Situationists were a group of avant-garde artists, writers, architects, and so on. But then it expanded to include students as well, who were engaged in countercultural activities that, in the 90s, they called culture jamming, like appropriating images from popular culture and repackaging them to deliver a political message. But I think they were also much more than just that. I think that they were, by 1968, they were well and truly activists. And indeed, they were revolutionaries. And they were never a mass movement, but their work, their texts, and their legacy, I think, far outweighs their size or the longevity of their organisation. And I think it's worth exploring why it is that the legacy of the Situationists continues to be felt today. And there's echoes of it, I think, in a lot of struggles today. So this is going to be a basic introduction to the Situationists, their organisation, how they developed, and some of their political ideas and practice. And importantly, I'll also go into their role in May 1968. However, while I'll introduce this particular current, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about the events of May 1968 themselves, or the kind of the narrative of it, except where it relates to the Situationists. So there are other sessions, I think, at the conference that deal with these questions in a much more direct way. If there's something that I say that you want more clarification on or have questions about, do raise it in discussion, or you can come and find me afterwards or something like that. So the Situationists had an organisation. It was called the Situationist International. Now that implies this kind of wide-ranging organisation full of, perhaps hundreds of people from around the world. It was not like that. It was, more like a few dozen who were members. And when we say international, it was really just kind of pockets of Western Europe who had kind of signed up to this international. But, they had aspirations, I guess. And the organisation was founded in 1957. And one of the key figures in the founding of the Situationist International was a man called Guy Debord, who I'll refer to more as we go on. And it's also some of the people that he had around him. And like I said, there were only a few dozen of them at the Situationist Founding Conference. It was in a tiny town in northern Italy. But nonetheless, in July 1957, the Situationist International was born, and they emerged from a group, like I said, called the Letterist International. This group, and also there were other groups, there was a group called the International Movement for an Imaginist Bauhaus. There was the London Organisation for Psychogeography, which had a total membership of one. So these were the affiliate organisations joining up to the Situationist International. But these kind of avant-garde art types, I think, emerged from particular trends in art that had preceded before, trends like surrealism, trends like Dada. And unfortunately, that in and of itself is you could do a whole other session on, Dada and surrealism and so on. So I won't go into them that much. But what I can say is that they saw themselves, as avant-garde. They saw themselves as wanting to unleash the power of the imagination. And indeed, some surrealists, people like André Breton, if you're familiar with surrealism, these people also saw themselves as revolutionaries as well. So the Situationists at first, they had kind of aesthetic concerns. So many founding Situationists were themselves, artists, architects, designers, and writers, and they were involved because they detested the art world. And they detested kind of the bourgeois artistic circles which they moved in and they would often find themselves in. So an example of this, which I really like, is in 1964, Asger Jorn, who was a Danish artist, and he was a member of the Situationist International, a contemporary of Guy Debord. He received the Guggenheim Prize for his work titled Dead Drunk Danes. I don't know if I can get an image of it up. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's this kind of conceptual painting. And he replied to the Guggenheims, who were affording him this prize, with the following telegram. Go to hell with your money, bastard. Stop. Refuse prize. Stop. Never asked for it. Stop. Against all decency, mix artist against his will in your publicity. Stop. I want public confirmation not to have participated in your ridiculous game. Stop. So you can see this is the level of contempt that these people had towards the kind of the dominant institutions, bourgeois institutions in society, and particularly the institutions of art. This would be a running theme, actually, within the Situationist International, because it's a kind of... And the artists who identified as Situationists, because while on the one hand they rejected the art world, as you can see with the example of the Guggenheim Prize, actually the art world loves a rebel, so they would try to take them in, and there were various members of the SI over the years who Guy Debord actually kicked out of the organization because he felt like they were just trying to cash in on the the cachet that comes with being a rebellious Situationist. It became quite fashionable, and so he was always kind of on the lookout for that. And the artistic practice itself was also it was a rebuke to kind of conventional ideas of what art actually is. So one of the members of the Situationist International, Giuseppe Pino Galizio, pioneered what he called industrial painting, which is where he would just take kind of rolls and rolls of canvas, and they're quite remarkable. It's just like meters and meters of canvas, and he would kind of hook them up to a machine, and then he'd just like do kind of random paintings on it. And so it was the idea behind that in his manifesto on industrial painting, which was published in the Situationist Journal, goes: when thousands of painters who today labour at the nonsense of detail will have the possibilities which machines offer, there will be no more giant stamps called paintings to satisfy the investment of value, but thousands of kilometres of fabric offered in the streets, in markets, for barter, allowing millions of people to enjoy them and exciting the experience of arrangement. So trying to find ways to break out of the kind of commodification of art, which these people often, these were the environments they had to work in. So for the Situationists, they had a critique of capitalism. They saw that capitalism was a total system, not just confined to the economic sphere, not just to confined to the sphere of production, of work and labour and so on, but there's a system of commodification that pervades every social sphere, including the art world, but also other institutions under capitalism. And so this recognition of capitalism as a total system is a major theme of Situationist thought, and hence breaking that mould, constructing situations or moments that were, what they saw as kind of ruptures with the existing bourgeois order, a moment in which human desire could be truly expressed. That was, I think, a real motivating or driving force for Situationist artistic practice, and then eventually political practice. So the two main methods associated with the Situationists are what we call, what they called détournement and dérive. So détournement in French simply means like hijacking, and it's what I referred to at the beginning, the kind of the culture jamming. So they basically, they take, extending on things like data, using found materials, existing texts, and they turn them on themselves. So, for example, if you know the famous cover of the Sex Pistols album, Nevermind the Body, like that is a kind of a détournement. It's taking a picture of the Queen and then refashioning it to, in this case, to be an album cover. But But usually it's an act of irreverence towards the appropriated images. And so this wasn't just an aesthetic technique. It started, I think, from a rejection of art as private property, and indeed that any cultural artifact could be owned by one or more people. And so it rejected the idea of plagiarism, for example, because the idea of plagiarism concedes that it's a kind of theft, that someone owns the thing that you're plagiarizing. So they didn't care about that. And in fact, all of their archives are just freely available. There's no copyright on any of the work that they've done, because they rejected the idea that you could own it. And rather, the situationists saw that culture is kind of there for appropriation, for turning it into something else. An example of this is the film that Guy Debord made, where they took a Japanese samurai film and dubbed over the Japanese dialogue with French, and they made the film to be about the proletarian rising up against the ruling class. So that's an example of that. Now, the other technique that the situationists pioneered was called the dérive, which is it's just French for detour. And anyone who, I personally find the technique of the dérive very appealing, as would anyone, I think, who spent, a day in Paris, because the dérive is about wandering the streets of your city against the typical routes that you would normally take. And it was about wandering, in this case, the streets of Paris, in a deliberately unplanned way. And it related to situationist ideas around urbanism and what they called psychogeography, which in short just concerns the way that human beings exist in a city. So, the city in their view is constructed not for people, but to ensure the movement, the efficient movement of capital and commodities around the city. And yet human beings, we have to live in these cities and these huge concentrated numbers. And so the dérive was a way to disrupt the order that this world of commodities imposes on the way that we live in cities. And again, we might think that we get to, we choose to go where we want in cities, and so, no one's telling us where, directing us. There's no, Berlin Wall that cuts through our city. There's no checkpoints in the city of Melbourne or anything like that. There's no roadblocks. And so we might have a sense that we're free to roam about the city as we choose. However, according to the situationists, our movements and our experiences of the city are entirely predictable. And these are based on economic and social motivations. And that when we let go of these and allow ourselves to drift through a city without motivation, simply as we desire, then this is the dérive. And in fact, I noticed there's actually an app that you can download now, which is called dérive, which you can use to, take your journey throughout the city. I haven't downloaded it. I don't know how it works, but it sounds tempting. But Debord lays out this theory in his article called The Theory of the Dérive. And he writes, "In a dérive, one or more persons, during a certain period, drop their relations, their work and leisure activities, and all the other usual motives for movement and action, and let themselves be drawn by the attractions of the terrain and the encounters they find there." And he bases his theory on a study by a sociologist who observed and mapped out the movements of one of his students over the course of a year. And Debord writes that her itinerary forms a small triangle with no significant deviations, the three apexes of which are the School of Political Sciences, where she was a student, her residence, and that of her piano teacher. And so the student's experience of the city is an extremely narrow one. This is someone who, at the time that Debord was writing, would have most likely come from a middle-class family. As she was a student, she would have had a relative amount of financial freedom, at least. And yet, she, over the course of a year, her movements were just restricted to one tiny pocket of the city. And what more, for example, a French worker who does not have the same kind of financial freedom as this student might have had, who's working in the same factory for up to 10 hours of the day and then retreating home, going to work again. At least this student got to go to piano lessons, which broadened that scope. So, but at some point, I think artistic practice for the situationists was not enough. And I want to now move on to some of the more political and philosophical conclusions that the situationists came to, as expressed in the seminal text for this situation is current, which is called Guy Debord. It's called Society of the Spectacle. People might have come across it, and it's written by Guy Debord. I'll just show you a short clip.
Before we do that, there's someone something is like making a lot of noise.
It's their vents. Yeah.
It's really annoying.
Yeah,
but it was someone's phone. Sorry.
No, it's okay. So in 1973. So this book came out in 1967. Debord made a film in 1973 based on this work. And I'll just show you a short clip. So you can see, I think with the film, I think it brings into like a lot of what I described, particularly the thing about the detournement. It's an appropriation of different various images overlaid with Debord's voice reading out his work. I hope people could see some of the subtitles, maybe not. But this highly influential work was published, like I said, in 1967, and it represented, I think, a recognition on the one hand of the limitations of purely aesthetic practice. The derives and the detournements and so on. I think there was a recognition by the Situationists that this could not form the basis it couldn't actually take down the world of commodity fetishism or anything like it. Because it was, limited to people who, back to that French factory worker who's working 10 hours a day, they do not have the ability to just, whimsically, wander around the streets of Paris, as much as they might like to. The publication of this work represented, a move away from just aesthetic practice to something more political and indeed more kind of revolutionary thought. And so Society of the Spectacle is an attack on the degradation of human life under capitalism. It's composed of 221 short theses. It's full of aphorisms, such as the one that I ended with there, which is quite a famous one, which is that in a world that has really been turned upside down, the true is a moment of the false. I particularly like that one. It's an inversion of Hegel it appropriates Hegel. So it's, you can see again, it's employing that method of detournement. And it can seem like nonsense at first, almost like something out of Lewis Carroll, like from Alice in Wonderland or, some kind of nonsense kind of phrase. But I think it really does relate to Debord's idea of what the spectacle is. And so for Debord, the spectacle is, and I quote, not a collection of images, but rather it is a social relationship between people that is mediated by images. All that once was directly lived has become mere representation. And the spectacle is the accumulation of these images, and then eventually the decline of being into having and having into merely appearing. So this, what does that all mean? So the spectacular society, according to Debord, describes the kind of inverted image of the society that we live in. One where human relations are replaced or usurped by relations between commodities. And so these commodities come to, rule over us. Life ceases to become about living, as he kind of says there, and it's about having. And so this relates, I think, to, Marxist concepts of, alienation, reification, commodity fetishism, and so on. And so there was a real attempt at this point by the Situationists to go back to Marx, basically. Now, I want to stress here that there is a difference. Well, I think that there's a difference between what Du Bois is describing as the spectacular society, which is a critique of mass consumer culture, and the kind of and commodity capitalism, and the kind of anti-consumerist arguments that are more kind of prevalent today. In that, what he's critiquing is the spectacle. He's the fact that capitalism disguises the social content and the social relations of the world of commodities. They basically, you would think that they just exist as these economic relations with other commodities and money and so on. Then that human beings aren't really a part of that. And human labour, which goes into creating commodities, is disguised and written out of the equation. But the other thing here is that his critique of this spectacular world he doesn't blame ordinary people for being duped by this system, but rather he argues that there needs to be a construction of situations. The definition of what a situation is much more now associated with revolutionary events that can actually rupture the existing order, not simply appropriating bourgeois images or taking a different route in a city, but much more events like the Paris Commune. So that was something that they looked to. That's a situation. That's something that can, kind of rupture the bourgeois order. And also the other thing as well about, I think, Du Bois' analysis is that he looks to working class agency and working class power as a way of achieving this rupture with the system. Now, I thought I should also focus here on their role in 68, because I think that because this was published in, it's a year before the events of 1968 occur. I think it can also be a little unclear if you just read kind of text from Du Bois and some of their stuff, just what precise role they actually had or what impact they had during the events. Now, from what I can gather from kind of my research of the situationists themselves, the Situationist International, this organization I've been describing, didn't directly intervene as an organization into the events of May 1968. But rather, as I flagged at the start, there's a whole lot of students who took up the label of situationism and self-identified as situationists. So what did that actually mean to them? I think it was part of a kind of a proliferation of ideas of the new left, basically, during the 60s. So on the left, it was the ideas around situationism that were a break from social democracy and the institutions reformist institutions that were represented by them, such as the National Union, the French National Union of Students, called the UNEF. But it was also a break from the Communist Party and the Stalinist organizations that existed at the time. These were organizations that claimed to be Marxist, claimed to be not just Marxist, but were the official organs of Marxism in their countries. And so this was a break from the mechanicalism of the Marxism associated with these organizations, and also the Associated Trade Union in France with the French Communist Party, which was called the CGT. So situation saw itself, I think, and the people who identified with situationism saw themselves in May 68 as anti-bureaucratic. They saw themselves as truly Marxist, or at least trying to rediscover what a true kind of Marxism was, and for the working class. And so one of the main slogans of the Situationists that they continually raised throughout May 68 was all power to workers' councils. Now, there's a gulf, I guess, between raising of a slogan and the reality of that slogan coming to fruition. But you can see they very much centered, I think, their analysis and their kind of revolutionary thought on proletariat power. Now, one of the groups that formed during May 68 was a group called the Entaché, or the Enraged. And they were formed at Nanterre University, which was kind of ground zero for May 68. It was the university where the first big kind of occupations and protests started, not just in May. They were kind of from the beginning of the year of 68. And so, the Enragé were a group formed at Nanterre in the struggle against the police presence at their university. And they eventually found their way to a theoretical agreement with the platform of the Situationists. And they began what they called an assault on the order of things. So people might, I'm not sure if you might have, there was a session today about May 68. You might have heard the anecdote of the dormitories and the issue of so basically at universities, students had to be in either, you know, single-sex dormitories, either male or female. And one of the actions that the students took part in was going into dormitories of the opposite gender. And so this was something that the Enragé had a really big role in organising. And it wasn't just purely because they wanted to visit opposite-sex dorms. I don't know, they wanted to have sex or whatever. Like, it was about disrupting the order of things, that there was this arbitrary division on their campus between male students and female students, and they wanted to, you know, rip that apart. Because that was the point of that. And they were also famous for their slogans. They went around graffitiing slogans like "Don't work." This was a very famous, like, "Don't work, don't take part in the system." But also things like "Occupy the factories," "Power to the workers' councils," "Abolish class society," "Down with spectacle commodity society," "Abolish alienation," "Terminate the university," "Humanity won't be happy till the last bureaucrat is hung with the guts of the last capitalist." Yeah, it's a bit of a longer, you need a bigger wall for that one. But "Death to the cops." "Free also," it's like a postscript. "Free also the four guys convicted for looting during the May 6th riot." So, like, these were the things that they were scrawling on the walls of, like, universities, not just in Paris, and then eventually it spread to the Sorbonne, which is, like, the main university in Paris. As well. So the Situationists were also part of what was called the March 22nd movement and part of the rebellion at Nanterre, like I said, which provoked the May events. And they would go on to play a key role in the occupation of the Sorbonne University on May 13th. And so this was after what was called the Night of the Barricades, which was on May 10th, which was when students in the Latin Quarter of Paris built up barricades of, like, burning cars, ripped up the cobblestones from the streets, hurled them at police, you know, all of that, and fought pitched battles with the riot police well into the early morning. And so this was after that. They went to the university and they occupied the main building. And what characterized these students was a real hostility, not just to the, you know, the bureaucracies of the administration and of the police and the state and so on, but also to the bureaucracies within their movement. And so they had a real hostility to, you know, leaders of the student movement, including people like Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who was one of the famous, the famous leader, I guess, of the student leader of May 68, but also especially the Stalinists. They hated anyone who was associated with the Communist Party and would often do things like stage walkouts if there were, even if, like, there was an instance that I came across where former members of the Communist Party came into the room to try and participate in this General Assembly, and the Situationists said absolutely not, and they staged a walkout, and all these people were like, they're fine, they're not members of the Communist Party anymore, but it was not, you know, it was kind of not good enough from their standpoint. And that's what I think, because sometimes I think quite often they veered into kind of sectarianism. They also had this analysis as part of their intervention into May 68, which was that the working class is where the real power in society lies. And so I'll read an excerpt from their statement about the occupation of the Sorbonne. "So the occupation of the Sorbonne that began on Monday, May 13th, has opened a new period of in crisis of modern society. The events now taking place in France foreshadow the return of the proletarian revolutionary movement in all countries. The movement that had already advanced from theory to struggle in the streets has now advanced to a struggle for control of the means of production. Modernized capitalism thought it had finished with class struggle, but it started up again. The proletariat supposedly no longer existed, but here it is again. The student struggle has now been left behind. This is while they're at the occupation of the Sorbonne, actually in the student struggle. So, and they're like, the student struggle has been now been left behind. Even more left behind are all the second-string bureaucratic leaders who think it's a good idea to feign respect for the Stalinists at the very moment when the CGT and the so-called Communist Party are terrified. The outcome of the present crisis is in the hands of the workers themselves, if only they succeed in accomplishing, in their factory occupations, the goals towards which the university occupation was only able to hint at. And so you can see there the real... I think there's the real thing that characterises the situation is a kind of impatience. Is a real they. It's a time when I mean, you can understand it. It's a revolutionary moment. They just want it to happen, and they have no patience, no truck with any of these bureaucrats who want to limit what they see as this revolutionary movement. So. Students around the world would also come under the influence of situationist ideas and situationist politics. And they would range... A lot of these groups, I don't think, are particularly similar in any way. There was Subversive Action, which was a group in West Germany. There was a group called Provo in the Netherlands, which seemed to be... which stands for provocation. And one of the things they did was they went to the princess's royal wedding and threw smoke bombs at it. Like, this was the kind of... antics are so not particularly political, but also the Japanese Zengakuren movement was also under the influence of situationist ideas. So you can see that they weren't just kind of aesthetes and artists and so on by the end. These people were, I would say, they're Marxists. They wanted to rediscover a kind of a true form of Marxism as against the bureaucratic Communist Party. And I think they were right to oppose the Communist Party, and right to try and find something else. The Communist Party played a incredibly counter-revolutionary role, for what it's worth, in the May 68 events, held back struggle at every step of the way, and so they were committed to early Marx, but also other Marxists like Karl Korsch, Georg Lukács, some of these types. They hated the bourgeois order. They wanted to realise a truly liberatory art and philosophy in everyday life, but they centred their project, or at least attempted to centre their project, in theory, on the abolition of class society and working class power. And if there's one way of describing them, it's impatience, impatience with each other, impatience with the rest of the left, impatience for revolution. They were denounced as ultra-left, which I think in a lot of cases is true. They perhaps were, at least in kind of their statements and so on, and in their critiques of leaders. But I think that, I think there was a validity to a lot of their criticisms as well. And the other thing about them as well, which I think is really important, is I think the thing about returning to early Marx is I think that they were attempting to recover agency and the role of working class agency in revolutionary movements. That revolution isn't just something, socialism is not some inevitable thing, that there is a role for ordinary people to play in creating that revolution. And so there's a very famous situationist slogan, which is all power to the imagination. And I think it can come across, if you don't understand the context, as just a kind of a whimsical thing, like all power to the imagination, let's be creative and whatever. But what they mean by imagination, I think, is this thing. It's consciousness, it's agency. It's about the creativity of the oppressed and the working class in attempting to overcome revolution. And so just to kind of finish, I guess, May 68 was really, I think, the high point of the situationists in terms of their activity and in terms of, their activity mainly. They disbanded in 1972, and while some of the official members of the Situationist International would go on to do artistic practice and political work and so on, many kind of just became scattered, and that's kind of it. But I think their legacy, though, lives on. Just firstly, before I get to that, I think that there are a few limitations which is worth drawing out, of course. I realised that as I was reading through this again, I come across as quite soft towards the situationists. But, I mean, obviously they do have their limitations. One is the conception of organisation. They had a conception of organisation, clearly, because they had the Situationist International, but they were by no means an organisation that attempted to, you know, recruit people. They had no attempt. They would intervene into struggle, but not to try and bring people with them necessarily, or to convince people to get on board with their project, but rather a lot of their interventions into particularly May 68 were quite denunciatory and quite ridiculing of the left. I actually really want to find I don't know where I had it here. They have this like really wonderful, well, I think I quite like it. It's like a takedown of Daniel Cohn-Bendit. Basically, they just say that he was not intellectually up to the challenge of being the leader of May 68, and that the movement was far too radical for him, and he was basically just a mediocre activist, which, you know, is obviously is quite juicy, but not helpful. When you're part of a movement. The other thing about on the question of organisation is that Guy Debord himself, the kind of self-appointed secretary and leader of the Situationist International, was an incredibly temperamental political figure, very flighty, and he regularly expelled people from his organisation on a whim, some for, you know, greater or lesser crimes, but like he would just say, no, counter-revolutionary, you're out. And he would do this routinely. There were no democratic structures within this organisation. There was no attempt for people to influence the course or the direction of this organisation. It was just up to the handful of people up at the top to make the decisions about what this thing did. And so this can't form the basis of any ongoing organisation, left organisation, that can properly direct the course of struggle. The other thing as well is about their slogans, which they're quite famous for, and particularly the thing I kept coming back to, which is the slogan of working class power. Now, as much as those slogans had a focus on working class power, the base never really, they were never really had roots in the French working class. Their base was among students, it was among artists, it was among intellectuals, and so that placed limitations on their ability to spread their ideas among workers. As good as they might have been, as pure as they might have been, they weren't really able to do that. And it's true that the Communist Party of the time and the Trade Union Federation blocked radical students from being able to take part in some of the factory occupations or to reach out to the workers that were taking part, you know, in an attempt to spread the struggle, to radicalise it, and so on. But also, the fact that the Situationists, like I said, was so hostile to the rest of the left, and so agitated by, you know, anything that was not, you know, pure, and their kind of sectarianism to other forces, that meant they couldn't work in common struggle. They struggled to struggle with other left forces, like the occupation of the Sorbonne, for example, where they regularly would stage walkouts. They'd denounce other figures for, you know, having control of the sound system because they couldn't make announcements like they wanted to, or, you know, various little petty things like this. But that was how they operated. And so, like I said, I do have a certain softness, a soft spot for the Situationists, because I love their radicalism. I love their contempt for kind of, you know, bureaucracies, their contempt for the established order. They really, really wanted to tear down capitalism and every facet of it. They wanted to get rid of it and have a society that was truly liberatory, truly emancipatory, in which people could just express themselves and be themselves. They hated the way that this world of commodities, you know, limited people's ability to, you know, to live and to have, genuine kind of interactions with each other. And so I love their kind of irreverence, I love their radicalism, and it's something I think we could use a lot more of today. I think it would be wonderful if there were more people who were as agitated as the Situationists were in 1968. And so the legacy of the Situationists, there's a legacy that exists kind of in, the academic world. So, for example, Society of the Spectacle is something that is often, I think, taught in like media studies and our cultural studies and things like that. So that's one aspect of the legacy. But I think that that legacy, it's almost, I think it's quite banal, because I think that to reduce situationist theory to merely a critique of kind of mass culture or mass media, I think takes away, it removes the kind of revolutionary content of that analysis, because it wasn't just a critique of that society, it was offering an alternative to that. And I think that the better legacy of the situationist today, I think, is in the various movements that have erupted in recent years. Things like the Occupy movement, I think, has echoes of situationism. Things like Nuit Debout, which was a movement that took place in 2016 against the labour laws, that occupation of the Place de la République in France, Paris, that had echoes of that. And they appropriated situationist slogans. One of the slogans that was appropriated, and this is where I'll finish, is a slogan which is the title, which gives the title to this talk, which is Beneath the Paving Stones, the Beach. Now, this, again, it's one of those things where it can seem kind of whimsical and nonsensical. What does that actually mean? Well, there's a very literal meaning to that slogan, which is that on that night of the barricades that I described, where they were ripping up, the French students were ripping up the paving stones, they found that underneath the paving stones was a bed of sand that it was laid on. So there's a quite literal meaning to beneath the paving stones of the beach. But the more kind of, I guess, the revolutionary meaning to it is that every single inch of this order that you can tear apart, everything that you can break apart, rip open, it gives you a glimpse into what a future society could look like. A truly liberatory and emancipatory society. And so, I'll finish there.